Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hello and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. This is one that I've been looking forward to for a little while. It's actually with Alan Williams with Understanding Ag. You all probably know him, so I don't need to give an introduction, but we're talking a lot about the importance of, well, first of all, the right type of an animal and genetics, but also epigenetics and how the environmental, your environment and your management affects the long-term expression of genes in an animal and in that environment. And so it's a really cool conversation. I feel like I learned a lot. He's definitely way smarter than I will ever be, but he does a good job of putting it into a way that hopefully you all will be able to understand. But before we dive into that, I wanted to take a little bit here to thank our sponsors for the Herd Quitter Podcast. And you guys can help support the show by supporting these sponsors. If you're looking for what these guys are offering, I only get sponsors on that I believe are doing a good job. I want to give a plug to that first. But our first sponsor and supporter of this podcast is Ranch Right LLC. And I was actually looking at their website here not too long ago, and it was reading kind of on their page, and it talks about growing a ranch business is frustrating. And without a team to help, they said you leave a bad business to the next generation. And for some reason, that kind of stuck with me, the idea of, you know, if say you're operating and you're surviving, you're cash flowing for whatever reason, maybe that's equity in a business or off-farm income, either you or a spouse or investments you have elsewhere. And if you continue to operate that way because you can, someday the next generation may take over your operation and not have that same off-farm income. And you end up leaving a bad business to the next generation. So if you want to avoid that and leave a good business to the next generation, you have to know your numbers and have a good business plan. And the folks that I recommend is John Haskell and his team at Ranch Right LLC. So you can check them out at ranchrightllc.com. Moving on to the second show sponsor, and this is another company that I'm a believer in because we use them, and that's Barn to Door. We use them for all of our website hosting platform needs. They make direct marketing to consumer, both online and in person, easy. They've allowed us to increase our sales for our farm business. And if you're looking to build a successful farm business, I'd recommend Barn to Door. They have the best training teams and support. They really do everything that we've needed them to do. So I'd recommend you check them out. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter. And if you sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session as well. That's a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter. That's all I've got for ads, but I'm really looking forward to diving into today's conversation. A reminder that if you enjoy what you hear here and you think that somebody else might benefit from it, I'd sure appreciate a share, give a 5-star review in whatever platform you're listening. Apparently that helps with the algorithms and getting this out to more people. So thank you so much. And with this, we'll dive into our conversation with Alan Williams. Thanks so much, Alan. I appreciate you joining me here on the Herd Quitter Podcast. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Well, same here. I really appreciate the opportunity. Looking forward to chatting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to have you on for a bunch of things, but the one that kind of sparked my interest here lately was a discussion group, the discussion group on the Faro Cattle Company website. You're on that. Kid has a few kind of experts on there that can share some thoughts and perspectives. And they got into a conversation around epigenetics. And that one, something that intrigued me, something that I know just enough about to be dangerous, but I thought it'd be worth having an expert on to talk a little more in depth about that. And so that's what I want to at least start with talking about today. But before we actually get into that, maybe I'll let you just introduce yourself for a short while here to those two or three people in the world who haven't heard of who you are anyway. Just maybe give an intro about yourself and what you're doing.
Sure, be happy to. So again, I'm Alan Williams. I'm a 6th-generation family farmer and rancher. I also spent about 15 years in academia as a researcher and professor. So I had that experience as well, but I am back farming and ranching, on a full-time basis. But we also formed some other companies. I'm one of the founding partners of Understanding Ag, of the Soil Health Academy, and of our most recent launch, Regenified. And all of that, all of our effort, whether it's our farming, ranching, or it's, Understanding Ag, the Academy, or Regenified, it's all focused around regenerative agriculture as a whole, whether we're talking about livestock production, crop production, specialty crop production. We work in all of those. So we have been blessed now to we're working across more than 34 million acres.
Wow.
And we're working in, dozens of countries, 40 plus countries. We've really been blessed and being able to spread the good news, so to speak, of regenerative agriculture and to help a lot of people in a lot of places.
Yeah, for sure. It's super cool that the expanse that you guys have found in really a pretty short while. What's how many years is, I guess there's all these different groups, but kind of the connection between you and some of the other founders, how long have you been really going at this?
Yeah, so we originally founded Understanding Ag in 2016.
Wow.
The four original partners were myself, Gabe Brown, David Brandt, and Ray Archuleta. It really hasn't been that long. You know,
I know.
less than 10 years, right? That we've had Understanding Ag and the Academy, and then we launched Regenified. This is just our third year. Going into our third year of Regenified. So, it's not even 3 years old yet.
No, that 8-year history on Understanding Ag, that's pretty impressive. And it's become not a household name kind of in the regenerative world. You guys are the go-tos, and so congratulations on that success. But so the one I wanted to talk to you about, I guess, today is again epigenetics. And I'll preface this with talk to me like I know nothing about it, because my understanding of it is so minimal that it's not even worth pretending that I know a lot. But there's going to be a lot of people listening to the podcast who probably know about the same as me or even less. And so, just as a start or a beginning, what is epigenetics? And I guess I don't know if it varies what livestock species you're talking about, but most of the folks that I'm listening to are livestock. So maybe from a cow calf perspective, talk about epigenetics, I guess. Is it? Yeah.
Absolutely. So just in the way of background, my formal training and what I taught and did research in at the university was genetics and reproductive physiology. So by formal training, I am a geneticist and a physiologist. And I say that to admit this. Even as a geneticist, there were quite a few years of my life that I absolutely ignored epigenetics and the importance of epigenetics. And it has only been within the last, less than 2 decades of my life, really, that I have come to understand the very profound importance and impact of epigenetics. So let's define epigenetics. Epigenetics is the influence of environmental factors on the degree of gene expression in an individual. And now that's anything with genetic material. Okay, so epigenetics can occur in us, and it does. Epigenetics occurs in all of our livestock, our cattle, and everything else. It occurs in everything that grows out there. So, all of our plant species, whether it's a perennial pasture crop, an annual crop, a row crop, whatever it may be. So, any organism that has DNA is impacted by epigenetics. So we need to realize that. And we need to realize that, for instance, if we're raising cattle on our ranch, that's not the only species we need to be concerned about relative to epigenetics, because the cattle are eating the forages that are growing out there. So we really need good epigenetics in all of the plants that they're eating.
Sure.
We need good epigenetics in the soil microbes that are working underneath the soil surface and feeding those plants through the roots and all of that. So with all of these other organisms that are contributing to the health and well-being of our livestock, we need to be concerned about it, their epigenetics as well. So now that definition for some people may still be a little hard to wrap their minds around. Well, okay, you said environmental factors and how they influence, degree of gene expression. So, Alan, what in the heck does that mean? Right? So let me give some examples and analogies here to help everybody understand this a little better. All right. So think of a light switch on a wall. So a regular light switch, I flip it on and the lights are 100% on. I flip it down and the lights are 100% off, right? Well, that's not epigenetics. Okay, that's either on or off, one or the other. Epigenetics has to do with the degrees in between. So now think of that same light switch, we install a dimmer switch. Okay, so when I turn it on, I can have the lights 10% on, 20% on, 50% on, 80% on, right? Anything in between, all the way on and all the way off, I can control with that dimmer. So I can have degrees of light. That is what epigenetics does. Okay. So every pair of genes in our body, in the body of our cattle, or in a plant or a soil microbe, there's degrees to which the genes can express themselves. They never express themselves 0% or 100%. It's always somewhere in between. And that's epigenetics. Epigenetics controls how much any gene pair can express itself in me, you, or our cows. And let me give another example here to help people even better understand this. So think about our eye color. So I have blue eyes. And that was genetically determined, okay, by the genetics of my parents. So I have blue eyes, but there's many, many different shades of blue, right? So my epigenetics is what determined the shade of blue my eyes are. So my eyes could have been anywhere from a very dull light blue to a brilliant blue or anywhere in between. Now, what do I mean then by the epigenetics influencing the shade of blue in my eyes? Well, what my mother ate during her pregnancy, okay? What she was exposed to during her pregnancy are all environmental factors. How much exercise she got or didn't get during my pregnancy. Okay, all of these are environmental factors that determined ultimately the epigenetics of my eye color, as well as many other traits that I have. So the epigenetics, the environmental factors that my mother experienced during her pregnancy when I was in utero in the womb, and even shortly after birth, all of those things impacted my ultimate epigenetics. But it even goes beyond that. So, what my father did, okay, and the epigenetic influences that he created in the sperm that fertilized that egg, okay, also contributed to my ultimate epigenetic expression for any given trait. So that's what we're talking about here. Again, degrees of expression, just like that dimmer switch on a light.
And it's like weird because you can never know what could have been with a different scenario because you can't go back and do something again. So how do you define, how do you know what's been affected genetics versus epigenetics when you can't? Yeah, I don't know if that's even, it's a complex conversation. It's just a weird
thing, because for sure there's going to be natural impacts or environmental impacts on everything, but how do you define what was environmentally impact and what was just purely genetic impact?
So nothing is ever 100% of one or the other. Okay. And this is why, when we look at genetic selection in our cattle, for instance, and we look at either selecting using an EPD or gene marker technology, right? That's never 100%, and it never, ever will be because of epigenetics. So an EPD can never be give you exactly what you think it may give you. And even the name tells you that it's expected progeny difference, not guaranteed progeny difference, right? And even a DNA marker technology. And again, I'm a geneticist, okay? So I know how all of this stuff works very, very well. I did this when I was at the university. But even with DNA marker technology, it can never be 100% because the epigenetics are going to ultimately influence, again, the degree of expression of any gene pair. Okay. And the accumulation of gene pairs in the body. So what we can influence now, initially people's reactions may be, well, then how can I even influence this? This just sort of happens. So what does it matter?
Well,
Well,
that's the
no, it.
question to me is essentially is, what does this mean for the practical application of this understanding, I guess?
There you go. So it doesn't just happen. Okay. Our management on the ranch, on the farm, plays a huge role in the expression of epigenetics in an individual, in an animal. And here's the deal. Epigenetics follows what we call the rule of compounding. So let me give everybody a quick definition of the rule of compounding and then relate it back to epigenetics. So the rule of compounding is this. In nature and biology and life, there never are any singular effects. Everything that occurs creates this whole series of compounding and cascading effects. And these effects are never neutral. They're either positive or negative, one or the other. Okay. So epigenetics absolutely follows the rule of compounding. Epigenetic effects are never neutral, they're either positive or negative, and they are compounding in nature. And they're compounding in the life of an individual. And there's multi-generational compounding. So we know from research that epigenetic influences are transgenerational. So they can impact the next generation, the next, the next, the next. As a matter of fact, so far in research, it has been found that the transgenerational effects of epigenetics can last through more than 10 to 12 generations. So what this means is that what we do matters. Okay. So let's walk through this a little bit. So if I want to create positive epigenetic effects in my cattle, then I need to be about the business of reducing their reliance on external inputs and pharmaceuticals and all of those other things. Because when I'm using a lot of inputs, a lot of supplements, a lot of additives, a lot of pharmaceuticals, all of these types of things with my livestock, I'm actually creating negative epigenetic impacts in my animals that are going to be transgenerational in nature. Okay. So that means that the offspring are going to be even more reliant, and their offspring even more reliant on all of those inputs. So when we peel back these inputs And we allow our livestock to instead have to rely more on what they're supplied by nature out there on the rangeland, out there in the pasture, without all of these additives and supplements and everything else. We're building very positive and strong epigenetics that are also transgenerational. And that's going to result in animals that are more and more trouble-free and far healthier and experience greater longevity, okay, in their life. So there's actually quite a bit of peer-reviewed research that shows that, if we're using a lot of pharmaceuticals, for instance, in our livestock, we are creating negative epigenetic effects. If we're using a lot of chemical dewormer, we are creating negative epigenetic effects. If we're spraying a lot of herbicides, things like that, and then our animals are eating out there, we're creating negative epigenetic effects. If we're feeding a lot of supplement, and look, I'm always very straightforward. Okay. I'm just going to tell it like it is. So, folks, even the things that you may be calling, quote, regenerative or whatever in the supplement world, if you're creating an ongoing reliance on those, and when I'm saying things like that, I'm talking about things like, apple cider vinegar, basic H. I mean, we can go on and on. Okay. If that's what you're doing and you're doing it year after year after year, you're creating negative epigenetic effects in your livestock over time because you're making them reliant on that supplement. Okay. You're making them reliant on that supplement. So I don't know any other way to say it except to just say the truth.
No, and that makes sense. And so I guess I'm going to say something that I've kind of always felt or thought, and it seems to maybe align in my mind. We'll see if I can get it out in words that aligns with what you're saying well enough. But in my mind, anyway, I've always thought, these genetic markers or EPDs might potentially show the genetic potential of an animal if environmental factors were not a limitation. And in a large amount of seed stock production systems, or even a lot of commercial operations, oftentimes those inputs that you're talking about, different things, are the essentially creating the no limitation of environment that allows those animals to meet that genetic potential without needing to be epigenetically adapted to the environment, because they're manually adapting the environment to meet the animal's genetic potential, as opposed to creating the animal that's epigenetically through generations adapted to the environment that they have naturally, I guess. Does that track at all or make a little
Yeah,
sense?
absolutely. And it's so let's take a pregnant cow as an example. Okay. So you've got a pregnant cow and she's pregnant over the winter, and you're feeding a lot of hay, a lot of cake, and any other supplement all winter long while she's pregnant. You just negatively epigenetically affected that calf for life. For life. Because that's what that calf experienced from a nutritional standpoint in utero was all of that cake, all of that hay, all of that supplement throughout the winter months. And you've pre-programmed the epigenetics of that calf during that in utero period. That's fetal imprinting. And so again, that creates a negative epigenetic impact on that calf. So rather, let's say that instead, okay, if she's pregnant over the winter, we had far less reliance on supplemental feeding because we paid attention to our pastures and our rangeland, and we were able to build and stockpile grazing for the winter months, so that those cows can be out actively grazing over those winter months and rely far less on the supplemental feeding through the winter. Now you're building positive epigenetics in that calf in utero. and that calf is going to be far stronger epigenetically, in during its entire life, and it's going to pass that down to its offspring as well.
From a practical perspective, so this is the fetal programming is something I had never really considered here until just a couple weeks ago. And Dr. Annibal Portomingo from Argentina was at an event that I was at talking as well. And he talked about fetal programming from the perspective of meat quality and how, in his particular context, that he was talking about was saying that an animal that is not abused, but grazing harder, tougher forages in the winter, that those calves are more likely to have poorer tenderness, I think was the main metric he used in the finishing program, and that your fetal programming is kind of for poor quality and meat quality. And in my consideration, I guess, and I don't know, I've always thought most cow calf producers are selling weaned calves. Our goal is to be as profitable as we can at the cow calf sector, but there's this almost conflicting. If you're trying to breed for cattle that thrive in a low input environment, but those decisions are also going to be impacting meat quality and tenderness potentially at the end. Yeah, it's a kind of a tough challenge. But maybe over generations, the cattle that continue to get more adapted to that environment will have less negative impact on the meat quality 5 generations down the road after having been epigenetically adapted to a certain forage type or feed type. I'm not sure.
Well, see that, and herein lies the rub, and this is where we have a lot of myths and misunderstandings and misperceptions. Okay, and I call this, you're right, but you're wrong. Okay, if you're producing very conventionally, and you're continuing to produce very conventionally, and you have low diversity and or monoculture pastures, and you've selected what I'm going to call the wrong genetics. You've selected genetics based on DNA marker technology and the best, the top 10% of EPDs and, whoever won in the show ring or whatever, right? You are going to be reliant on all of these inputs and all of these aids and all of these supplements. You're not going to escape that because you have epigenetically selected for animals that have to have that to really thrive. And that's going to drive your cost up. Okay. And you're not going to escape that. So again, you're right, but you're wrong. All right. And we have to think about all a lot. And again, as a former university researcher, the vast majority of research that's been done and the research findings are based on those limitations on very conventional production. So that research is right, but wrong. Okay. So here's how it's wrong, and here's how, as a producer, you may be wrong. If you start focusing on building soil health and microbial species diversity in the soil, and you start focusing on building plant species diversity in your pastures and on your rangeland, and you focus on selecting animals that fit that environment and are highly adapted to your environment, because an EPD doesn't tell you that. I'm sorry. And neither does DNA marker technology tell you that. Then you will make incredible progress. And I've been doing grass-fed production probably longer than any of your listeners on this program. I started in the 1990s, maybe a few started before then, but I doubt it. So I've been doing this a long time, a very long time. And what I can absolutely tell you definitively is that we have no problem with tenderness. None. We have no problem with marbling, none. And we have no problem with flavor profile and customer satisfaction. Why? Not because I'm using EPDs. And please remember, I'm a geneticist saying this, okay? It's not because I use EPDs. And I'll tell you, I don't anymore. I don't. I never even bother to look at an EPD anymore. They're completely irrelevant to me at this point, even as a geneticist. I never look at DNA marker technology. It's irrelevant to me as a geneticist. Okay. Here's why. Because I'm core focused on the epigenetics of my animals and what's happening there. And all of that other stuff just gets in my way, and it confuses the situation. And what I have found is if we select animals that epigenetically fit our environment, they're highly adapted to our environment. And we have an environment that is rich in soil microbial profile and rich in plant species diversity. You do not have to worry about marbling. You don't have to worry about tenderness. And you don't have to worry about end product flavor profile. All of that goes out the window. And so all of these other considerations, the things we thought we once had to worry about to get high quality grass-fed beef, absolutely go out the window. And our animals marble very well. They're always tender, and they always have an excellent flavor profile. And we've got data to prove that. And oh, by the way, we've also got phytonutrient data on all of this that clearly shows that the phytonutrient profile is far better as well. And not just better than the grain-fed. Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, anywhere from 200 to over 400% better than the grain-fed in almost every phytonutrient category. Okay. But far better than grass-fed, where those animals were on a low diversity or monoculture finishing diet with soils that had much less microbial species diversity. All of that is also epigenetics. So that's where it gets us. You essentially, all of the things that we think we're concerned about and that we got to select for, the truth is, if we're core focused on epigenetic selection for animals that really work epigenetically, all the rest of that works itself out, and we can forget about having to do all this single trait selection.
Well, it seems to me what I'm coming to an understanding here as you talk is like, so again, like this genetic EPDs and stuff show the genetic potential of an animal if environment is not a limitation. But if we're focused on a low input environment-based business and matching a cow to our environment, then what her genetic potential is doesn't matter because the limitation doesn't fall with her genetic potential, it falls with the environment. And so why select based on a genetic potential question when that's not our context? We're focusing on an environmental limitation. And then if that's what we're focusing on is a cow herd that matches our environment, not a maximize a non-maximizing environment, then we have to select on something different and we select on a little more. What, so I guess what are you selecting then by if it's not EPDs, it's based on phenotype. What are you seeing? Results, you know, I mean, I guess the one I oftentimes say is, you know, reproduction. If a cow that gets bred back year after year after year in a certain context, that's generally a pretty good sign that she's beginning to get adapted.
Yeah, so I'll share what we do, but first I want to ask a question, and this is just a general question for everybody listening. Is there a single ranch or farm out there that doesn't have environmental limitations?
Not a ranch, but like I would say is like most people are, well, they'd make up for environmental ranching limitations with inputs, and that's where they don't have a limitation and it gets expensive. But if you're focusing on purely what a ranch produces, then exactly, the ranch is going to be
There you
the
go.
limiting factor.
Every ranch is going to have environmental limitations, period. And they're going to differ depending on where you're located, right? Every one of us is going to have environmental challenges, period. It's unavoidable, inescapable. And it's not profitable to have to supplement or augment those environmental deficiencies or challenges. Okay. And so where we hear people complain all the time, Man, I had, do you know how much hay, how much money I had to spend on hay this year? How much money I had to spend on cake this year? How much money I had to spend on dewormer or vaccines or antibiotic? Or we hear this all the time, right? And complaining about how much they had to spend. Well, you had to spend that because you were trying to work outside of your environment, you know, your environmental limitations. And so you're the reason you had to spend that money. Don't blame the environment and don't blame nature. Don't blame anybody else. I call it, we have to go home, go into the bathroom and look in the mirror. And that's who we have to blame, the person we see in the mirror. And I've had to look in the mirror a lot myself. Okay. I've made tons of mistakes, tons of mistakes. And I'll readily admit them. And so I've had those long, hard looks in the mirror personally. Now, back to your question then. Okay. Since environmental limitations are unavoidable, what then do we really do for solid epigenetic selection? Well, number one, you got to knock the props out. If you're continuing to prop your cattle up, even if you're propping them up again with what may be termed a regenerative supplement, and I'm going to argue that if you're having to supplement over and over, year in and year out, day in and day out, it's not regenerative. I don't care what it is,
It's
folks.
funny you mentioned that. Literally 5 minutes, I had to end the call to get on the call with you. I was talking with somebody who was saying, what's the difference between apple cider vinegar and cake? The cost is about the same, and each of them are some sort of a supplement to bring, hold up cattle. And there's going to be a lot of people probably who hear this now are pretty pissed off at that comment. But for some reason, apple cider vinegar is looked at as some natural, it's great. We got to use it. It's good. But it in a way is just a supplement like anything else to prop hold up cows that maybe aren't working. Hey, Kit, bull sale season is coming up soon. I was wondering if you might want to talk a little bit about the Texas sale coming up here shortly.
Texas is going to be our very first sale this year. It's Tuesday, April 2nd, in Cameron, Texas. We're going to have 40 Red Angus bulls there, 27 Black Angus bulls, 6 Hereford bulls, and 56 heat-tolerant composite bulls. That's going to probably be our biggest offering of heat-tolerant composites ever, and maybe our best offering. The heat-tolerant composites will work great along the Gulf Coast states, up as far as Tennessee, Missouri, and those areas. When summer gets here, the thing that's going to be most important for those hot areas is animals that can stay out and graze when it's hot and gain weight. So be our Texas sale. It's going to be the Tuesday, April 2nd. 2 days
Awesome.
later, we go to the Missouri sale.
Cool. Looking forward to it. Well, now we'll get back to the show.
Okay, so who's feeding apple cider vinegar or cake to the deer, to the bison, to the elk, to the antelope, to the moose, to the caribou, on and on and on, right? I mean, how in the heck did they survive all this time without somebody going out there and supplementing them, on a continual basis? And by the way, how did our cattle survive all of this time before we had cake, before we had apple cider vinegar, before we had anything else? Right, that we're supplementing with today. How did they survive and thrive without that? And look, go back. I mean, everybody that's ever listened to me, you know that I do a lot of study of scripture, and I talk about agriculture from a biblical stewardship standpoint. And go back and study our forefathers, okay? What did Abraham do? What did Isaac, Jacob do? What did Job do? What did Moses do? What were they supplementing with, folks? Okay. And I think scripture tells us they built incredible herds that were increasing in numbers. That was their wealth. And they built incredible wealth through this without all of the props that we just automatically think that we have today. And even my more current ancestors, I'm sixth generation. Look, when I was growing up and prior to me being born, my parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents weren't feeding our livestock all of these supplements. Okay. So how did they make it for generation after generation without all of this that we believe now today that we have to have? Now, what I'm not saying is that may some of these things be helpful in the interim, in the short run? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that if what you're doing is saying that we're going to create a reliance on these supplements, whatever the supplement may be, and I can never wean off of it, now I've got a problem. And now I'm creating negative epigenetics. I'm creating a reliance on that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you got to begin to knock the props out. Now, does this mean that you're going to have some fallout and you're going to have some culling? Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. And you want that to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because again, if I'm supplementing and propping up for the weaker animals in my herd or in my flock, that's what I'm selecting for. I'm selecting for weakness, not strength. I want to select for strength. So what's one of the ways that we do that? So first and foremost, every heifer that is born, unless there's just something way wrong with her, okay, obviously wrong with her, but every heifer that is born gets an opportunity to breed. To calve as a two, not a 3-year-old, mm-hmm. as a 2-year-old. Okay. And this is without supplementing them to breed at 14 to 16 months of age. We're not doing that. Mm-hmm. Okay. They got to do it on their own with what they're eating out there with their mothers. They're not sorted off and then fed up to achieve a certain breeding weight. Okay. So every heifer gets an opportunity to be bred. Period. Mm-hmm. Now, that statement was just said by a guy that more than two decades ago was doing practically every measurement known to man to select replacement heifers. I was measuring hip height, mm-hmm. heart girth, pelvic area, doing reproductive tract scores, weaning weight, yearling weight, on and on. All of this, looking at their EPDs, you name it. To select heifers. I do none of that now, not a lick of it. And I don't need it. Yeah. There's zero measurement at all. They just get simply thrown in with the bulls. And if they're given a short time to breed, 45 days, mm-hmm. 45 days. Okay. So what breeds? Just bought a ticket to the cow herd. All right. I go in 30 days after I remove the bulls, I ultrasound preg check. Those that didn't breed bought a ticket to the grass finishing herd, mm-hmm. and they become meat. Yeah. So I didn't lose a penny on them if they didn't breed it. And I could care less about the percent breed up. You know, that's another thing we always hear. Well, I'm targeting 85 or 90% breed up in my heifers. I'm going to say, really? If you're doing that, and that's your goal, you are selecting for negative epigenetics, not mm-hmm. positive epigenetics, because the only way you're achieving that is you're supplementing and propping them up mm-hmm. pretty heavily to get that 85, 90% breed up.
Yeah.
And so now, may it happen in a given year without supplementation? Yes. And that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. But what doesn't breed, and there's many other ways to make money off of them.
Yeah.
You know, or keep a bull in with them, and then if they didn't breed within your time frame, fine. You still got a bred, sell them to somebody else's breds. Mm-hmm. You know, we turn them into meat, okay, and make money on them that way. The second thing that we do is the ones that are bred then get put back in with the mature cow herd, and they calve with the mature cows. Mm-hmm. We don't calve them separate. Again, you're talking to a person that used to do the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I sorted them off. I fed them up. I tried to get them to that quote magical target weight to breed. I wanted to have 80 plus percent breed up, all of that. And then I babied them all the way through, you know, being bred back with that second calf. And I calved them separately. I had a heifer calving field pasture up near my pens, you know, in case I had to pull a calf or whatever. And I would calf check every 4 hours around the clock.
Yeah. Okay?
And I thought I was this wonderful husbandman. Mm-hmm. Man, look at me sacrificing out here, right?
Yeah.
And now I know I was an idiot. What was I doing? Yeah. You know, really? And I was creating my own problems. Mm-hmm. We pulled, you know, a much higher percentage of calves than we ever should have. We had more abnormal presentations than we should have. Why? Because we had them up in a calving pasture. They didn't get much exercise. I created the abnormal presentations. If they get enough exercise, they're moving every day, grazing, 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 moving from pasture to pasture, paddock to paddock. Then that calf can rotate far better and far more properly for proper orientation mm-hmm. coming through that pelvic canal for birth. Okay. Mm-hmm. I created the abnormal presentation problem by keeping them up and them not getting and feeding them and all of that, and them getting very little exercise. Mm-hmm. So I discovered that that was my, again, I had to go look in the mirror. Okay. So, and this all goes back to epigenetics. So every bit of this is tied back to epigenetics. Okay.
Yeah.
So they get thrown in with a mature cow herd. There is no calving check whatsoever. None. We see them every day when we move them because we move our cattle every day to a new paddock.
Yeah. Okay.
So we see them, but we don't spend tons of time out there calving checking. We just don't. They have to calve on their own. Now there's a huge benefit, both psychological and epigenetic, from calving with mature cows. When I've got heifers calving by themselves, not a one of them has calved before.
Yeah.
Not a one of them has ever experienced this before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're all naive. I got a bunch of naive teenagers out there is what I have. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you got teenagers talking to teenagers. And guess what? If you're wanting somebody to learn something, that ain't the way that happens.
Yeah.
Teenagers have to have elders that they're talking to learn from and to glean wisdom from. They're not gleaning wisdom from each other. They're making mistakes. So it's the same thing here with these heifers. What we have found is that when we put them in with the mature cows to calve, then the mature cows actually act as midwives. Okay. Mm-hmm. Guys, if we think cattle don't understand what's going on and communicate with each other, we're poor husbandmen.
Yeah.
And we don't understand our cattle at all. Okay. Mm-hmm. They communicate with each other incredibly well. And the mature cows actually help the first calf heifers. And the first calf heifers are able to watch what the mature cows do. Mm-hmm. So we have far less calf rejection by mature calf heifers when they calve with the mature cows. You know, it's this incredible learning experience when they're all together. And they're together in a familial unit. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That also creates positive epigenetic impacts as we go forward.
Yeah.
And then for rebreeding, the heifers are in after that first calf with the mature cow herd, not treated any differently than the mature cows. And if they fail to rebreed after the first calf, well, they become meat again.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still young enough. They'll produce a high quality carcass. They'll fatten up really quickly. And so I don't hesitate. You know, you don't get a second shot at breeding. And that's lifetime. So there are no excuses, no matter what happened to the calf, period. No matter what, even if I ran over the calf with a truck, the cow goes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the cow goes. So we select for longevity. We never cull cows. You know, there's a lot of seed stock operations that have what they call a mature cow herd dispersal, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And so they'll call all their 8-year-old cows or whatever routinely and get them gone. Why would I do that? Then I have no idea what my longevity is in my animals. We routinely have animals that are 15 to 20 years of age and have had a calf every single year since they were two.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that. I've gotten in a debate with some friends of mine who are more commercial seed stock guys, and their thought, and theoretically, I guess I can see their logic, is that your heifers are your most, your furthest advanced genetic. They should be your best animals. Your heifers should be your best animals, or the bulls out of heifers should be your best animals because they've had the most time to genetically advance. And I've said the same thing, is like, there's something to me in our system that is very similar to what you've laid out there. A bull out of a 13-year-old cow that has gotten bred year after year after year in a tough environment that has proven that she can match this context, that bull means that bull, that says a lot more about that bull's potential to me than out of the heifer that is completely unproven in my context or my environment. And that makes a lot of sense. And I just, to like all of the things that you've highlighted there come down to a simple summary of just like this idea that when you select for, or when you fix any symptom, when you cover up, prop up any symptom of either a cow that can't bond with its calf and get it, you know, milking by itself, or can't have a calf, or can't get bred without supplement, or can't do whatever, you're unintentionally selecting to continue to reproduce that and expand that within your herd, and you're not eliminating those problems. And I guess maybe some of that comes out of a mindset of, well, Jim Gerrish talked about it. I watched him talk last fall, and he shared like the differences in cost, in the cost structure of the cow calf business from 1973 to 2023, 50-year period, and the cost of inputs like feed, fuel, labor, like a baler, and fertilizer have increased between 800 and 3,000 times, whereas the value of our beef has only gone up 181%. And so a lot of this, just to kind of, people who hear this might be taking personal offense. We do things because maybe at one point 50 years ago in that economic environment, it made sense.
Yeah.
But the same things don't make any sense anymore. And when we can manage to get similar results by selecting for this epigenetic selection, we're going to find, I mean, all of this leads to ultimately more profitability, and for especially, for the cow-calf guy.
Well, the average cost per cow in a cow-calf operation now on an annual basis, when you count all cost, is running between $850 and $1,100 a year per cow. Okay. When you look at the real numbers across the cow-calf sector in the U.S., it's the range, the normal range now is $850 to over $1,100. Okay. And we're seeing that. You know, we've done a lot of this analysis ourselves. Our cost last year was $353 per cow.
Yeah.
Okay. And we didn't feed a single bale of hay to the cow herd. You know, now, and a lot of people, well, Alan, you're in Mississippi. Okay. So I understand that. But you know, all of our neighbors fed last year between 120 and 150 days. Okay. All of our neighbors. So why did we not? And they had to. And of course, their cost were significantly higher than ours. So, you know, most cow-calf operations, quite honestly, cannot afford to own haying equipment and do their own hay production. If you need hay, you're far better off contracting and buying your hay and importing somebody else's nutrients to put back on your ground than you are doing hay yourself. And when you look at, you know, when you truly do the analysis on that, and it's like you said, look at the cost of balers, rakes, mowers, and tractors today, right? Far, far, far greater than they were just even 10 and 20 years ago. And so, and then what happens when we are doing our own hay from a management and even epigenetic standpoint? We're spending a lot of time during the summer cutting, raking, baling hay rather than moving our cattle on a day-to-day basis from paddock to paddock to paddock, observing our cattle, observing our pastures, observing our rangeland, all of that. We're too consumed with cutting, raking, and putting up hay to really pay attention to our cattle. So our epigenetic selection is suffering, and our management of our cattle is suffering because of that. And then what do we find ourselves doing all winter long? Feeding back that hay. Every day going out there and cranking a tractor or cranking a truck, you know, however we're feeding our hay, hauling that hay out, dumping that hay, and feeding that hay. We're burning lots of fuel, taking up lots of labor. We got wear and tear. We got depreciation, repair and maintenance, all of those costs. That if instead I had, instead of having any of my acres dedicated for hay production, they're all dedicated for grazing. Now I can stockpile for winter grazing. And so in the winter, I'm feeding little to no hay, and I'm just moving them from paddock to paddock, just like I did in the active growing season, just like I did in the summer. Those animals are staying far healthier. It's far less costly, because all that's required for me to do that is an ATV or UTV, and I'm running out and moving a single strand of polywire. Mm-hmm. So my labor costs, my maintenance costs, depreciation costs, da-da-da, are all far, far less. And I'm influencing positive epigenetic selection because they're actively grazing during the winter rather than being propped up by heavy supplementation.
Yeah. And something that kind of popped into mind here based on what you just said there, you talked about all these things in the system that are the cost savings. And it's the system that really makes the difference. It's not the cow, where people focus so much on a cow and they never focus on what their system actually looks like. They think their salvation is going to come from buying the right bull, this top genetic thing, and whatever that looks like. If you never change the system, it's not going to change anything. But having the right type of cow, this cow that you've described, that you've raised, that we're doing at our place as well, is what allows you to totally change your system and change your cost structure of your business entirely. If you were to take my cow or your cow and place it into 90% of cow herds in the United States, their profitability wouldn't change. If anything, it probably would go down if they try to match your animal or my animal to their high input environment. Kind of back to that conversation about genetic potential. If they're in a high input environment where they're providing all the input they need, our cattle don't, maybe my cattle probably don't have the genetic potential to do what their system enables them to do. And they're probably not going to do as much, but by focusing on the right type of cow and then making this massive business model and production model change, that's where you can go from, instead of maybe going from $1,000 in calf to $1,050, because you have this prime instead of choice or whatever, and you've focused on carcass traits, you can go from a cost of $1,000 to a cost of $350 because you totally changed the system. And that's where things get exciting, I guess.
Well, it is. And, you know, we've run for more than 20 years now. We've run data on looking at, production cost and then, you know, your actual revenue generated and all of this. And what we have found is through epigenetic selection, which, by the way, also predicates that you are going to be selecting for the right size animal for your environment. We have found that when we do that, we can actually run 20%+ more total cows on the same acres. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that we always, for the last 20+ years of running this data on many different ranches, we always produce more total pounds of beef off of that same ranch. Always. Okay. Not once has that failed to happen. So now that almost always means that we're selecting for a smaller animal than what most people think they have to have. But if I can run 20 plus percent more of them and I'm producing more total pounds, I'm making a whole lot more money off of my acres. It is never about maximizing weaning weight or yearling weight, ever. As a matter of fact, that's the wrong direction to go. You will always cost yourself tons of money in the long run if that's what you're focusing on. It's never about individual calf weaning weight. That's actually utterly irrelevant to me. I could care less about individual calf weaning weight. I'm always looking at total pounds that I was able to produce because every pound has value. Every single pound. I'm getting paid off total pounds. I'm not getting paid off of an individual calf and what their weaning or yearling weight was. Why would I even want to focus on that at all when that doesn't determine my profitability?
It's cool because, yes, exactly. You're producing more total pounds per ranch per, on a given land base. Generally, smaller calves are worth more per pound, so you're getting a higher price per pound if you're selling wean calves, and you're doing it at a lower cost because it's a lower input. So, I mean, talk about ways to improve gross margin. You're increasing gross product and both increasing production, increasing price, and you're reducing direct costs all in one system. And then if you can take it a step further, like you do, and direct market it, I mean, that's even a whole nother game, but vast majority of producers are selling weaned calves or commodity beef somehow. And so just purely looking at a commodity perspective, the model makes sense.
Well, and if you look, so let's go by load lot, that same example. Okay. 50,000 pounds of calf on a truck, right? So if I put 50,000 pounds of six weights on a truck versus 50,000 pounds of five weights on a truck, which 50,000 pounds is going to return me more money?
Yeah, the five weights.
Well, of course, the six weights are bringing you, on average, $8 to $10 back of the five weight. And I've still got 50,000 pounds. So this is a no-brainer. But yet it's amazing how many producers never even think about that. 50,000 pounds is 50,000 pounds, period. And the only class of cattle that has a roll up in price, roll up in value as you add weight is a cull cow. But anything below a cull cow has a roll back in price as they add weight.
No, that's agreed completely. No, we need to change how we view our model of production, and this focus on individual animal weaning weight is just so far out of whack. And maybe, I guess I'd maybe back in the day, 50 years ago, when costs of everything were cheap, maybe it made sense then. But we're in a different world. So yeah, well, good. Is there anything else on epigenetics that's worth bringing up before we move on?
Well, just so the whole key here is, first of all, just simply understand this, that everything you do or maybe don't do is going to influence the epigenetics of your livestock. And those epigenetics are never neutral. They're either positive or negative, and they're compounding. They're transgenerational. So focus on that. If you really want to build a highly resilient herd or flock, a trouble-free herd or flock, and if you want to build in tremendous fertility and longevity and soundness, then you want to be about the business of epigenetic selection, not pure genetic selection. So shove aside all of the noise, all of the stuff that gets in the way, and focus on the things that really matter. Knock the props out, okay? Call those that fail. No excuses, no excuses. Just call them, get them out, take the hit then rather than later, and keep going down this path. And you will build the resilience. You will build the longevity. You will build the fertility and the soundness and the profitability. All of that will be there. So that will be my advice on Epigen. Don't get bogged down in what it means and the definition and everything else.
Yeah.
Just simply follow what I just outlined, and you will be selecting for positive epigenetics.
Yeah. Great. Great. Cool. Well, we don't even have to get into other topics because that took a full hour. That was awesome. I appreciate it. I definitely learned and understand better what that is, but I'll give you the chance here anyway to plug. I know you got a bunch of things going on, so plug whatever you'd like to share. I know you're always sharing good value. So I'll give you a moment to do that. And then also maybe where people can find you or reach out to you if that's something you'd like to put out there.
Absolutely. So if anybody ever needs any help in any way, don't hesitate to contact us at understandingag.com. You can just go to our website and you can reach us through there, or you can contact me directly at Allen, A-L-L-E-N, at understandingag.com. We've got a world of resources on the website. You know, we've got archive webinars. We've got podcasts. So this one will be linked to the website, or we'll link from our website to this podcast. We've got presentations. We've got case studies, tons of articles, and we're always adding new articles every month. Recommended reading list, online curriculum. So we have a ton of resources there to help you be able to continue to learn and to get better and better and better at what you do. The Soil Health Academy, we have 3-day schools that are always at host farms or ranches that are very hands-on, very practical. So anybody that really wants to learn a lot more, whether it's about adaptive grazing, genetics, nutrition, whatever the cropping, whatever the case may be, the Soil Health Academies are a great way to immerse yourself in that and to learn that. We, through both Understanding Ag and the Soil Health Academy, we have documented year over year a minimum of a 20-to-1 ROI. So for every dollar somebody spends on the academy or consulting or whatever, we return at least $20 or more, to that, to your operation. The third thing that I'll mention is Regenified. We launched Regenified just a little over 2 years ago. We're entering into our third year. And what we're doing in Regenified, that is a regenerative verification company. And so if you want to, be able to say to your customers that, yes, I can validate that I'm producing my beef, my pork, my chicken, whatever, regeneratively, Regenified offers you that, the ability to do that. If you want to sell, there's a lot of branded programs and food companies and so forth now that are also becoming Regenified Verified. So it's offering you an opportunity to be able to sell into some of those programs by becoming Regenerative Verified. The other thing that we're doing within Regenified is not just verifying your regenerative principles and practices, but we are also aggregating and connecting. So we are connecting producers, farmers, and ranchers with buyers and with those opportunities. And we have every single day, we have buyers calling in, not wanting just small amounts, but buyers calling in, hey, where can I get 3 million or 5 million pounds of beef annually that is regeneratively produced? Where can I get 3 million bushels of grain that is regeneratively produced? So we're having those calls again, literally every single day. So if you want to be a part of that, you know, there people are actually looking for this now. So this offers you an opportunity to be able to be a part of this growing supply chain that we're building within Regenified. Again, understandingag.com, soilhealthacademy.org, or if you're interested in learning more about our regenerative verification program, go to regenified.com and you can reach us there as well.
Well, I appreciate that. And that connection piece is the part that's desperately missing, because you can have a million verification programs out there and all these labels on your product. But if, you know, average farmer Joe isn't going to be able to connect to CEO of whatever company. So I appreciate that connection. That's huge. Thank you so much. Really appreciate this. And yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you. I've greatly enjoyed it.
The Herd Quitter podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.